Greetings to you, my friends. It is I, D. Trussell. I'm about to head to the airport to go to Madison, Wisconsin, where you could see me at Comedy on State. But I'm leaving you with this wonderful conversation with Ramdev. Ramdev was in India with Ram Dass and Neem Karoli Baba and the entire Ram Dass crew. I love Ramdev. He reminds me of Ram Dass, and I love our conversations. This one in particular was incredibly scintillating. We talked about tantric sex. Lots of other stuff too, but tantric sex. You know, there's more to the spirituality stuff than just meditating. And some people feel a little uncomfortable talking about it, but Ramdev, he really opened up. If you want to hear some interesting stories about the old days with Ram Dass and Neem Karoli Baba, or you're just interested in extending your orgasms, then this is the episode for you. If you don't want commercials in the DTFH, do you know all you have to do is go to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. You'll get commercial-free episodes. We also have a weekly meditation group. We get together every Friday, and it's lots of fun. I hope you'll subscribe. And now, everybody, welcome back to the DTFH, Ramdev. Ramdev, welcome back to the DTFH. It's so nice to see you.
It's great to be back, Duncan. It was nice seeing you at your gig in the city. That was fun.
It was so great seeing you and getting to hang out with you in the green room. It was a wonderful balance, because the show after my Satanist friends showed up. So like we had this
I balanced out the Satanist guy, basically.
Lady. So it was this, my friend William, who features for me, it was like, oh, cool, you're getting a nice buffet of spiritual traditions here. But it was wonderful to see you, and it meant a lot to me that you came to the show.
So did you get any feedback about you and me talking about tantric orgasms last time?
Well, no, you know what? I did. I don't remember getting specific feedback about that. I know people loved our podcast, and I know that I personally loved the podcast. And just actually the other day, I was thinking about, I was trying to remember what you were saying about tantric orgasms, and I couldn't remember. So I'm like, you know what? I guess I'll just masturbate the old way.
Well, I'm not sure there's an old way and a new way, but I hear what you're saying. So I've been thinking about, I'm going to be on the podcast again with Duncan. It was so nice connecting with him. And what would I like to bring up? And I really started thinking about you a lot, and how I also played a podcast with you and Jack, how you were trying to be a good meditator and a good student and things like that.
Yeah.
And to me, it seems like there's really different ways of approaching spiritual practice. And a lot of people approach it from things just aren't good enough. I've got to improve. I've got to fix things.
Yes.
And there's a sense of inadequacy. God is outside of me. God is up there. I'm down here. Practice is hard. I'm not very good at it. And there's another way of practicing of abundance, of I'm blessed already. That it's just letting go of these obscurations that lead me to believe that I'm messed up. But underneath all that is this whole Duncan, this whole Ramdev Dale that, and that's kind of the tantric view. Now, tantra can be kind of dangerous if you just jump in there. We were chatting before the podcast started, and I was saying that chamomile tea and whiskey are just as much God, and you said this great line about causes asymmetrical love handles.
It makes me an asshole. Chamomile tea gives me I kind of calm down. It's wonderful in front of the fire.
Right.
Whiskey's pretty great in front of the fire.
Okay, but the point is that if you do some of this other stuff first, if you do some meditating and some compassion work, then you can start letting go of all these judgments and dive into that it's all divine, that it's all good stuff, that like Buddha's not outside, Maharaji's not up there in heaven. I remember Maharaji saying, those Westerners, they don't understand. They think I'm this body, right? I mean, it's like yeah. who we really are. And even Vipassana meditation or mindfulness practice is based on the notion underneath it all that you don't have to try to figure it out or improve anything, but just by being present, you'll move toward wholeness. So this kid you were talking about from the Battle Buddies, who's
yes.
Having his young friends die as part of his foundation of supporting young people with cancer, that even the difficulty that he's going through because he loves people and they're dying, that's his practice,
right?
That I don't say this to too many people, but here I'm going to say it to like thousands of people, is that suffering is only suffering. Ramdas even said suffering is grace, right? So that
yes.
cancer doesn't cause suffering. Resistance to cancer causes suffering.
Right.
Your friend dying doesn't cause suffering.
Right.
Resistance to your friend dying causes suffering.
Yeah.
And of course you're going to resist having your friend die. But if we don't know why we're suffering, it's a lot harder to work with it. If you really get that you're suffering because you're pushing away your life or you're grasping at the good stuff, then it's a lot easier to work with it. Like in Tibetan Buddhism, they have a slogan, drive all blames into oneself. And yeah. that means not that you're blaming yourself, but you're not blaming the environment. You're not blaming Trump. You're not blaming the traffic. You're not blaming the weather for how you're feeling, right? Two people can be caught in exactly the same traffic jam, and they're both going to an equally important meeting that's really crucial to their well-being. And they're both going to be equally late. And one person's tearing their hair out and saying, why yeah. the heck is this happening to me? This is fucked up. I can't believe this is happening to me. And the other person's saying, well, there's nothing I can do about this. I really want to be there on time, but it looks like I'm not going to be able to be there. I might as well play some music.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yes. I mean, I want to talk about the Lojong drive all blames into oneself a little bit more. I'm glad you brought it up. The Lojong sayings that you know, I jump from one to the next. They're wonderful. Some stick in your head, then you forget the other ones. And then that one has actually been on my mind quite a bit. and I want
to be grateful to your enemies. That's always a good one.
Ooh, that's a good one. Don't do things with a twist. I like that. Abandon all hopes of fruition. Really love that one. But the drive all blames into oneself. So this I want to talk about because I think this is another of those potentially confusing translations. I don't know what the Tibetan for blame is necessarily, but I do know that out here in the West, we associate blaming oneself with the opposite of self-care. To blame myself is to hurt myself. There's shame associated with blame. There's like, you know, so...
Duncan, I don't think it's saying, I mean, I think it's a really bad translation and I haven't come up with a better one, but it's not saying blame yourself. It's saying the way you're blaming outside, you bring that back into yourself.
Yes.
You reclaim the blame and take responsibility for, here's what I'm feeling.
Reclaim the blame is like, that is an amazing, there you go. Reclaim the blame. And I understand this. I get it as someone who has experimented with that particular saying. The relief, that's the paradoxical relief that comes from no longer like trying to find the serpent in the whatever your particular garden may be, realizing the serpent's in you, not out there, that nobody's trying to hurt you in the way you thought they were, and that this is something you've been dealing with, not just for this life, for multiple lifetimes. My God, it's like beginning to wake up from a nightmare. Right. But the second part of the problem that I have with that saying, not problem, but a little bit of confusion about it, is that it is kind of easy. Don't do things with a twist and drive all blames into oneself. If I express to a partner or a friend or anything like that, I recognize that I have fucked up for a long time and that I can't expect the people around me to suddenly believe that angry, fiery, awful, aggressive thing that pops out from time to time is gone. I understand why you are, like, I get it. We can't expect other people to like just believe us when we feel like we've made some progress or something. But the whole drive all blames it on oneself. What if you try that, but some part of you is like, but also you are kind of annoying. You know what I mean? The external you, this person and then I start feeling dishonest. Then I start feeling like, ooh, I don't think I've fully driven all blame into myself. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do, but I don't know. I mean, it seems like, I don't know how to say this without being crass here, but
be crass.
For you to drive all blames into yourself, that doesn't require your friends to do that. They can still blame you if that's what's going on in them, right? Yeah, I mean, it's like you're doing your practice, your life is your practice, and your wife or your friend's practice is their life is their practice. So
yeah, right.
You're just doing the best you can, and maybe you've been an asshole. I mean, I was just dealing with me being not the best partner and having to like take responsibility for that. But it seems to me that if to the extent you drive the blames into yourself, then your heart is opening, and at least in the future, you're going to be a better human being.
Yes.
Right. It's like what's done is done.
Yeah.
There's another thing in Buddhism about becoming hopeless, which really drives people crazy. But it's not hopeless that the future isn't going to be better. You feel hopeless that this moment is going to be better than it is because it's exactly the fucking way that it is. It can't be any different than the way it is. So that like you're completely hopeless that this moment is going to be better. It's this moment, right?
I love it.
And then we just surrender into that, and that makes us going forward the better, more open-hearted guy. And then your friends can, like the better Duncan, come out the other end of the process.
Ramdev, like, I love what... Oh, please continue. Sorry.
Like Maharaji said... it's better to trust in God than to try to figure everything out.
I want to thank HelloFresh for supporting this episode of the DTFH. With HelloFresh, you get farm fresh, pre-portioned ingredients, and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. They've got everything you want. If you are looking for an easy way to eat well and save money, you can cut back on takeout and delivery and get started with HelloFresh. It's fast. It's easy. No more going to the grocery store to stock up on snacks. No more going to the grocery store and enduring the weirdness of grocery stores, the bleeps, the bloops, the people! Here's the thing. I've been using HelloFresh forever. We get it every single week, and it's awesome. If you're somebody who has yet to learn how to cook, if you are like me and you inevitably fuck up recipes by putting too much of something or not enough of something or realizing you don't have some primary ingredient, then HelloFresh is for you. Not only will you suddenly be making these delicious gourmet meals But also, you'll remember the recipes. You'll learn how to cook. And when the inevitable electromagnetic pulse from the sun wipes out the power grid, you will still remember those recipes. And that is going to give you a great cot in whatever survival community you end up living in. Go to HelloFresh.com/21Duncan and use code 21Duncan for 21 free meals plus free shipping. Again, it's HelloFresh.com/21Duncan. Use code 21Duncan for 21 free meals plus free shipping. That's insane. I'm not getting free meals because I've been using them forever. Take advantage of this. Can I get these free meals? I want the free meals. Friends, I'm telling you, this is a delicious meal delivery service. If you've been skeptical about these things, don't be. It's awesome. The recipes are incredible and the ingredients are great. Thank you, HelloFresh, for supporting the DTFH.
It's better to trust in God than to try to figure everything out.
Okay. All right. So, okay. I want to get to that point quickly. So I love what you just said about the hopelessness thing. Now, there was a show I did for Netflix called The Midnight Gospel. Within this show, there was an episode, the prison episode, where Jason Louv was the guest. But as we're trying to in the podcast with him, I said this very thing. How hopelessness is good. Like this whole sun will come out tomorrow bullshit. It's like what I was trying to articulate is what you actually, I wish I'd done a talk to you before we did that episode. But what I was trying to articulate was just that when you have what you need, hope kind of goes out the window. You know, you're not hoping for anything because you're there.
You're here.
You're here. Thank you. And it was a big discussion with the creators, with the other creators, because they're like, it just sounds so grim. It sounds so grim. Like, do you want to put that out there that, you know, hope, isn't this hope, faith, charity? These are the jewels of Christianity, right? Like yeah. Hope. And I, to this day, I still feel right. I still feel like I get tortured by my hope. Anytime I'm hoping, I'm wanting out of where I'm at.
Right on. I mean, there's a lot of romanticism about religion. And, you know, even in this discussion, we almost started out about compassion. I mean, about Tantra. In the beginning of spiritual practice, there's the Ten Commandments. If you're a Christian and yes. Yoga, there's the yamas, then the niyamas. Be a good boy, be a good girl. Don't kill, don't lie, don't steal, don't commit adultery. Don't do the things that create duality. But as practice deepens and you go into the more mystical part of religion, those rules fall away and you trust your heart. You're not stuck in your mind about all the rules. You're not hoping you're going to be a better boy. You're saying, okay, I've done all this practice and what is my connection to God right now?
Right.
How much am I being present? And like Maharaji said, I'm always in communion with you.
Yeah.
What would it be like if we actually believed that? How different life would be. I don't know if everybody knows who we're talking about when we say Maharaji. Do your people know Maharaji, Ram Dass's guru, Nim Crowley Babu?
Oh, yes. I don't know. I'm sure some of them are like, who is this? Was he a chef or something? Who is this? That's a kind of Italian chef. No.
Well, actually, Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now, and part of it was the cook's book, and Maharaji was the chef. He's cooking us all.
Right? That's right. Yeah, and you know, I do think, like, I, you know, with the because... you know, I've been studying Buddhism with David Nichtern, and he's a really great teacher, really good with me, because, you know, especially in the beginning, good Lord, did I want to jump into the tantric mystical stuff. I mean, that's exactly, I didn't want to go through any of the other bullshit, like get me to where I can levitate, come hard, and like drink as much as I want. I know we have many theistic people listening. I'm not non-theistic, but I've been, so maybe it's a semantic argument I'm trying to bring up here. I mean, do you think that this concept of emptiness, or what do they call it? There's a beautiful name for Aliyah, the great, you know,
Aliyah, yeah.
Aliyah. Is that God? Is that
Aliyah's
the same
a friend of mine. Aliyah is somebody else.
Okay. Aliyah is somebody who, screwed me in a real estate deal recently.
Oh, well, okay. I know Aliyah, you know Aliyah.
Aliyah. It's a dad joke. Unforgivable dad joke. But you know what I mean? This idea of emptiness, the concept of, unit of consciousness or non-dual reality. This equals God, or it doesn't? Do you think it equals God?
Well, now we're really going down a rabbit hole. And I'm kind of a theist. I mean, I've had a few experiences of God actually showing up in my bedroom. Hanuman showing up in my bedroom once, and another couple of things have happened. But it doesn't seem like it's reality in the same way that the microphone in front of me is reality.
Right.
Right. So from a Buddhist perspective, it's more you're surrendering into this emptiness, hopelessness, and hopelessness leads to fearlessness, leads to love. Yeah. Let me see. I lose all my good quotes. But anyway, there's this quote from Suzuki Roshi, my first meditation teacher, where he was saying, when we bow down to Buddha, there's no Buddha, there's just bowing. That it's like Buddha isn't something outside, that you're not bowing to some guy on an altar or some guy who's really wise. It's just the act of bowing itself. So that whether we're doing that to God or whether we're doing that to Buddha or whether we're doing that to the Dharma, it really is ultimately the same thing.
Right.
So that emptiness, pure consciousness is God. Or God is pure consciousness. And, you know, I mean, when we're talking about people dying, what survives death? You probably, maybe you believe something survives death. I do.
I do.
But I'm not sure that Dale jumps into another body necessarily. Although, like, there's the 16th Dalai Lama, so that means there's the 15th and the 14th.
Sure.
And there is this continuing thing happening.
I mean, look, I was just having a conversation about this with a friend and talking about the possibility of the great, infinite, endless, deep slumber. I think Socrates in his apology talked about, like, look, if I'm going to drink the hemlock, if you put me to sleep forever, thank you. If there's something after this, I'm going to keep doing my thing. So no matter what,
it doesn't make any difference. Right?
You've done nothing, but except maybe like giving me the greatest thing of all time. You know, the nihilist dream of heaven is non-continuation of consciousness. It's what Dawkins said. Death is the anesthesia that takes away the pain of life. Really nice, and it's a. I mean, you at some point you're like, oh, well, doesn't sound terrible. I do love sleeping, but the dreamless sleep, so to speak. But I mean, I do feel like that is as much a version of heaven as golden streets and, you know, the angels flapping around. I think it's a dream I don't know if that's really what happens. So I do believe in continuation. How that works, no idea. And honestly, I don't care.
That's right what I was now. Just going to say. I don't care at all either. Somebody asked the Buddha, does reincarnation exist? And he said, well, if it did exist, how would you live your life? And the guy thought a minute and he said, because I would want a really good next birth. I would meditate a lot and study the scriptures and be a really good human being. And then the Buddha said, well, if reincarnation didn't exist and you just died, what would you do? And the guy thought about it and he said, oh, revered one, because I'd only have this one chance, I would really meditate a lot and study the scriptures a lot and be a really good guy.
Really?
You know, it's, wow. I'm interested in what is practical, what can help me and you wake up and suffer less, and all the other beings around can suffer less, not all this theoretical. I mean, theoretical stuff is fun. I used to be a scientist. It's fun for the mind. But really what I'm interested in is how can we wake up?
Can we talk a little bit about that and a little bit about this, you know, the sort of the process? You know, for me, the whole thing started off as a kind of like, you know, a LARP. You ever heard that term before? Live action role-playing game where you hear about the spiritual stuff and you're like, yeah, sure, I'll make believe with all these hippies that maybe this is real. And you kind of don't believe it at first, or maybe the better way to put it is you don't want your heart broken by finding out it's not true. So to protect your heart from being broken by realizing it's yet another scam in the world, you just kind of like, at least me, I took a cynical approach to it. And then if you're lucky, even though the LARPing, all of a sudden something, you're like, wait, something's changing here for real. Like there's something happening here that is completely unique to my own experience of reality. Yeah. This is when you get beyond the Ten Commandments thing that you're talking about, where for me, that just means all of a sudden those moments where I would react to adversity with aggression, the moments have not gone anywhere. The reaction does not, and it's not like once I'm not a dick. It's like over time you realize something softened me up here. It's not happening like it used to. And yet you still, at least I still have inside of me like that burning, angry coal, like this, like, you know, the suffering, the flavor of my suffering is anger. It's still in there. It flashes out at the world, at my family. It'll just, all of a sudden it's on my face. And, but I'm not articulating it as much as I was, but it's now it's subtle levels of it, you know, more refined ways of expressing aggression, but it's still there. So what do you do with that? Like, is this thing, but does it go away, or are you just kind of pissed off for your whole life, but you don't react? You know what I mean? You have it in you, but it doesn't come. You're, and I don't mean suppressing either. It's, you know, I tried suppressing it. It never worked.
That doesn't work.
But I, you know what I mean? There's this sense of like, fuck, I know it's, I'm sorry for cursing. I know it's in there. I know it's in there. And then for me, what goes along with that is like this never ending sense of like, all right, how long is this going to last? Like how long before I revert to that again? And that makes me uneasy.
So the thing about how long is it going to last has a lot to do with hope. You hope it's going to end. You hope it's going to end. And the fact that you're not expressing it as much and it's happening not as frequently means that it's all downhill from here. It might be a really long hill. You know, I mean, we don't know about consciousness doesn't care how long it takes or how much it hurts.
Right.
But once you've really seen the truth, you're crazy for that. You're addicted to that. And there's some very, in most of us, some very deeply seated patterning, some samskaras that we have to keep looking at it again and again and again until you're tired of looking at it and you say, screw this. I'm just tired of being angry. I'm not suppressing it, but it doesn't feel good. It hurts other people, you know, and that your awareness and your open-heartedness is enough that there becomes a gap between the first arrow and the second arrow, that, you know, something happens to you, and before you react, you can just take a half a breath. You can take a mind moment of trusting Maharaji, trusting your own true self, drive the blame into yourself and say, okay, you know, I don't have to do that anymore. At the same time, Ram Dass had this line, which I still don't know if it's true or not, but he said, if you're a son of a bitch when you get enlightened, you'll be an enlightened son of a bitch.
You know, I've quoted you on that from the last podcast at least 30 times. It's one of my favorite quotes of all time. It really is like that. And I love that so much because I think within the contemplation of these traditions, you start having a fantasy of an enlightened you. You know, you think, oh, an enlightened me drinks chamomile tea. Takes herbal baths, gives my wife more massages, is like, you know what I mean? Like spends lots of time outside, is astounded by the beauty of the leaf as it gently drifts through the autumn air. You know, and you invent this crazy version of yourself. You never think to yourself, oh, well, actually that isn't probably not really what you're going to be like. You're probably going to kind of be like you are now. That I love it so much but I wonder about it. I wonder.
Okay,
but
when you were going back before about Buddhist emptiness is allowing emotions, particularly difficult emotions, to arise and not being identified with them. It's not the anger that causes suffering. It's grasping on the anger. Cortisol has a less than a 20-second life in your bloodstream. So an emotion arises, Boom, there's cortisol. And if you don't react to it, it's gone. But if you get angry about the anger or guilty about the anger, then there's more cortisol on the cortisol on the cortisol, and your adrenals are getting shot. So that, here's this incredible study they did. It blows my mind, and I'm just shocked that it isn't on the front page of the paper. 30,000 people, three groups of 10,000 people. First group, high stress. They believed that stress was bad for you. Second group, high stress. They were taught you could be aware of the stress. It's not necessarily bad for you. Third group, control group, high, medium, and low stress.
Okay.
First group died 48% more often than the second and third group.
Wow.
But the second group did better than the control group.
Wow.
That mindful stress is better for you than high, medium, low stress control group. So it's not the stress, it's getting lost in the stress. It's being there with whatever it is that's going on. I've been meditating for 50 years, Duncan. I'm still this neurotic, but I don't care so much anymore.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's like, maybe I'm not a son of a bitch, but if you're a neurotic Dale and you get enlightened, you'll be an enlightened neurotic Dale kind of thing, right?
Right.
It's like, and there's emptiness around it. It's like your mind is like the complete vast sky. It's empty. It's like, but because you think you're a you, you put a window frame around it, right?
Yes.
That's my sky.
Yes.
And then into that chunk of sky that's your sky comes a cloud of anger.
Yes.
Or happiness. Doesn't have to be a bad cloud, but a cloud of anger. If the cloud is big enough and the window frame is small enough, all you see is the anger.
Right.
I am angry. But
right.
If you, through practice, you expand your window frame, that same anger comes and you see it's contextualized in a blue sky and that it's moving. It's going to be gone someday. It's a very different experience to see the cloud in the context of the infinite sky versus it's all cloud.
It's a new year, new you, so give yourself a fresh start with MyBookie. Whether you bet to earn or to make the games more exciting, MyBookie gives you the most for your money with a redesigned deposit bonus. Just use promo code Duncan on a deposit of $50 or more to receive a cash bonus instantly to your MyBookie account. Using this bonus is simple. Bet your deposit amount just once and you're ready to cash out. It's no strings attached with MyBookie. You can bet on the NFL, UFC, or play for a share of big cash prizes in the weekly online blackjack tournaments. With so many brands to choose from, you need a platform that makes it simple to bet and win, like MyBookie. Bet anything, anytime, anywhere with MyBookie. Thank you, MyBookie. I want to talk to you about attachment to the sky. I want to talk to you about the fleeting glimpses when, like, the clouds part and you see the sky.
Right.
You get that feeling of being home. You remember, you're like, right. Again, waking up from some awful nightmare. but then it goes back to clouds. And then you feel, at least I feel worried because it's like, oh my God, the nightmare didn't end. You dreamed about some bullshit sky. Like within the nightmare, there was some sense of like, oh, and then you're attached to a dream. Now you're worshiping a false blue sky that really isn't there. And now you're just as attached. You're attached to some nonsense. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
I know what you're saying. And there's even a term for it. When you go more deeply into it, it's called the stink of enlightenment. That you've had these experiences of openness and you want that. You're grasping at it. You're trying to find it and hold on to it. You can't hold on to it. It comes from non-grasping. And Pema Chodron has this line, you're not the sky. I mean, you're not the weather, you're the sky. You're not the weather, you're the sky. But also, you're the weather, in my humble opinion. I mean, that's the tantric view, that even the anger, even the clouds is who you are. Let me read a very short part of a poem by Rumi. So in this poem, there's this guy who's complaining to God that his prayers are never answered. He never has anything back from God. And Rumi in God's voice says, the longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup.
Holy shit.
Let me read that again. The longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. So it's not that those things are impediments. They're it. It's all it. It's all the beloved. The beloved can only be everything.
It's like the longing is the tractor beam. You think the longing is coming out of you. You don't realize the longing is pulling you in. And that is so wild. That is so wild. So the longing is good news. Good news that you have this aching, rotten, you know, like feeling of wanting your mommy or something and you can't find her in the mall, you know, good news, because you have longing for something now that you didn't even know about. And now that is that's incredible news. If you've just achieved longing, you're there somehow.
The longing is God's response. He's saying, here I am. Yeah, you want this? And the longing itself is the knowledge that that's the return message. That's the secret cup. That's drawing you toward union. And once again, it's frustratingly slow.
Yes.
Ram Dass said one of the qualities that is the main determiner of how quickly we make progress on the spiritual path is how long you're bummed out when you fall down and get off the path.
Whoa.
Like, can you just get up and get on with it? Are you saying, oh, fuck me, look what I've done. What a lousy meditator I am. And there's this guy, Sri Aurobindo, who had a metaphor. He said, I was walking down the road and God knocked me over and I fell in the mud and I got up and I was shaking my fist at God saying, why are you doing this to me? And I got so mad at God. And then I continued down the way and God knocked me over again. And I fell in the mud again. And I got up and this time I didn't yell quite as much, but I was really mad. And then finally I got so far down the road that God knocked me over. I just got up and started walking again.
At some point you should be like, hey, is there any way you could stop knocking me over, please? Maybe we could just walk together. What happened to footsteps in the sand? Aren't you supposed to be carrying me and then it's your footprints? But yeah, I love that. I think that, I know what you mean. Cause the, one of the, I think unnerving things about potential fruition or whatever you want to call it, is that if you've been meditating for a while, you do experience these tiny, tiny glimpses. I mean, I in the early days of me doing this, I would get so certain. I'm like, oh, well, there it is. I guess I got enlightened. And then And then, you know, the next day I'm just a monster and I'm paranoid. I'm angry. And so then I started getting nervous if any of those things would appear in the meditation practice, because I would think, oh boy, yeah, here we go. This means some rotten version of you is on the way. And you do know what I mean? It's like I started getting nervous about any of these things, just in the sense of like, look, I don't want to get my heart broken here. I don't want to get attached again to some idea that, you know what, this stuff is working and I'm not going to keep hurting people around me with my untrained mind. You know, I'd rather just be a beast and just, you know, that's what I'm like, you know, than get these like little intermissions between beast moments.
But would you rather really be a beast, or would you rather be on the path to, even though it's difficult? Once you've tasted that spaciousness, Duncan, I don't think you can turn away from it. You'd like to, but it's always going to be there. It's like once you've had acid, life before acid is not possible. It's gone. It's gone forever.
That's right.
That level of delusion is gone.
Right.
There's another level of reality that is at least, if not more real than ordinary getting up and eating Cheerios, you know, and we know that that's there. And that, so what you're talking about is a stage where you're afraid that you're going to get hold on to this stuff or it's not going to work out.
Fall off the bike. You remember, I don't know, I mean, you remember when you learned to ride the bike? And then it's like the first few days of bike riding are not exactly like pleasurable because of the terror that the thing's going to tip over.
It's scary as hell, to be sure. But once again, those moments of freedom of you're coasting down the street on your bike and the wind is in your hair. And you're, you know, just you, all of a sudden you're moving in a way that you never did before. It feels like so good. It feels like there's an aliveness there that you can't really turn back from.
I have tested, you know, I think that, I was listening to Pema Chodron, this wonderful seminar she gave on Way of the Bodhisattva. I've been listening to that, and you know, she was talking about how in Buddhism, this invitation to really test it. And I always took that as a kind of intellectual analysis of the Four Noble Truths. And she was like, see if you can break it. Yeah. You know, you still in kind of what you're saying, like now try to fall off the bike. Try to not see it. Try. Can you try to not see it? Like try to get it away. Try to like blank your mind and get back to that place. Right. And I love that. I never understood that's actually what it meant. It was like, is this breakable? And I think that's a really joyful thing to hear, that potentially upon catching enough of a glimpse of the thing, you really just might, you might not have to like sink back into that level of the nightmare. That's a really beautiful thing. I'm happy to hear you say it.
Ram Dass and I and some other friends taught a course at Trungpa's Naropa Institute, the first summer at Naropa. And Trungpa's students were very wild. They were having these like orgies and there was like young girls and major drinking. But what Trungpa told his students, he says, meditate a lot, take care of your body, and do whatever you want to do, right?
Yeah.
And so people would have these like wild Friday night parties, and then Saturday was the all-day meditation, and you're trying to meditate, not me, but his students are trying to meditate with a major hangover. Didn't feel very good, right? And they, instead of saying, in fact, Maharaji never said to people, don't do this. He said, well, if you do that, here's what might happen. If you smoke a lot of dope, it heats up the brain, or if you do this. But he would never say, don't do that. He would say, you know, just keep loving God and trusting God and do what you want to do, and it's all going to work itself out.
Did you get invited to any of those orgies?
Wouldn't you like to know?
I would.
Well, it was a kind of a weird time, Duncan. It was 1974. It was right after Maharaji died. So we were all kind of in a slight state of shock, right? That
yes.
We thought he was immortal, that he was like the strongest thing on, he was stronger than Mount Everest. Like, right. And then he dropped his body, as they say. So, I mean.
You answered the question already.
I did do this one thing. Trungpa had a paper called On Conscious Drinking, not Unconscious Drinking, but On Conscious Drinking. And in the paper, he said that if you stay really mindful and clear as you get drunk, you won't get drunk in the same way. And in fact, one night he gave a talk. It was so brilliant that at the end of the talk, I went outside of the auditorium and the trees were glowing with consciousness. But when he got that talking, he'd had a carafe of sake next to him. He'd been drinking all night. Yeah. He got up and he fell on his face. But he was still so clear that you know, that the leaves were glowing with consciousness. So my girlfriend and I got a big bottle of sake and we said, let's try this. And we sat down, we started meditating. And every 5 or 10 minutes, we took a big slug of it. And at the end of an hour, I felt like I was on a psychedelic. My mind was so crystal clear. I was so wide awake, ego completely dissolved in sake.
Wow.
And when I tried to get up to pee, my body was totally inebriated.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, this is a reduction of what you're saying, but I can remember in the old days when I take acid and drink, and, you know, the alcohol would not dilute the consciousness, the acid consciousness. So, like, I can specifically remember drinking and drinking, feeling as clear as a bell, and getting up, and it's like, oh wow, I am hammered. My legs are not working, but I'm clear because that was very good LSD. We didn't have access to what y'all had access to when I was coming up. Like, we didn't have the Sandoz ampules, or I can't even imagine what y'all had. But we, every once in a while, you would find some that wasn't terrible. Yeah,
we had some good stuff. Ramdas, one time, he was cleaning out, he stored his stuff in my garage in Santa Fe, and he said, hey, here's a sheet of Owsley acid. Do you want it? I said, oh, sure. But it was really old. So I would give it to people, and they had one of two experiences. Either nothing happened, or it was the best trip of their whole life.
Wow.
And nobody knew which one it was going to be.
Wow. I guess it just depended on where, you know, like where the photons hit it. I've heard that, like, it's photoreactive. So
yeah.
Regardless, this, you know, for me, like, I can remember when I was drinking, I stopped drinking. When I was drinking, I can remember being quite excited about this prospect of continuing my alcoholism and still, like, being it's somehow working in my life. And then it just didn't work. Like, I couldn't do what he was recommending. I couldn't mindfully drink. I'd heard, like, you know, here's what you do. Drink. But the moment you're not doing mindful drinking, stop drinking. But my problem was, I wouldn't stop drinking.
Once you start, there's no stopping. I mean,
right,
that doesn't work that way.
Exactly. You know, but that's how I would get into it, is I'd be like, okay, tonight, this will be a mindful drinking night. And then, you know, a couple of glasses of wine in, it's like, yeah, what a nonsense. Let's just drink. And then I'd feel like garbage the next day. So, but I love it. I love what you're saying. And I do agree with it. I actually feel excited for people who can successfully drink, because it's like, good for you. Like, look, you just, you sipped a glass of wine through the whole meal. Wow. That's like better than like telekinesis. Like, that's,
I know, it's a major talent to have.
It's a talent that is, but you know, don't you think, like, even though in Tantra, it's like, there's also some aspect of know yourself. Don't trick yourself into thinking you're doing spiritual drinking when you're blacking out, or when you're getting, like, you're having physical disruptions with your body, that you're getting fat and you're getting puffed. Don't you think there's, at that point, you're like, okay, well, maybe tantric drinking works for enlightened Tibetan masters, but.
I'm not even sure it worked for Trungpa. I mean, he probably died of liver disease, but.
Right.
Just as an example, think about saying a mantra. From the very first stage of practice, we're saying a mantra of, please God show up. I kind of know you exist. I trust that. I know people that believe you. I felt it before. I don't feel it now. Please, I'm invoking.
Yes.
And then as you do that enough, gradually, hopefully, the heart opens. And as you're saying, so just say you're saying Ram. Om Mani Padme Hum Ram. You're saying Ram. And it's a love relationship with you and God. It's like back and forth. It's juicy. It's great.
Yeah.
But when you get to the tantric stage, when you say Ram, the sound is God. That just saying Ram is God.
Yeah.
That there is no distinction between God, the sound Ram, and you or me who's saying it.
Right.
So that each time you're saying the sound, it's God is there. You know, and so it could be the same thing with anger. In the beginning, you want anger to go away because it's messing up your life. And then you're having more of a love relationship with anger. There's a lot of juicy energy there. You can use it to be creative. In my life, this is maybe too personal, but if I don't either meditate a lot or have orgasms, or do something deeply creative, I get angry. Because it's the same energy.
Wow.
It's got to go somewhere.
Wow. Wow, you just answered. Oh, my God. I never made the connection. I know you probably have this. You go in, you go in to write, you go in to make whatever it is you're interested in making, or you're just going in with the impulse of, I'm going to make something. And for whatever reason, the stars don't align, and it just doesn't happen. It's very similar to, and maybe this is being too vulgar, blue balls. It's like nothing. Nothing.
Nothing's being created.
And then at the end of those days, that is for sure rough evenings. That is where I'm pissed. I feel grumpy. Wow. Because it's not that you're angry because you didn't make anything. It's that didn't get expressed. It didn't get alchemized. Yeah. That's what you're saying. Wow, that's wild. That's the coolest thing I ever heard.
Let me read you a short poem from Hafiz. Know the nature of your beloved. In his eyes, your every thought, word, and movement is always, always beautiful.
That was
what being around Maharaji was like, that you were there, I was there being very neurotic, and yet he kept loving me no matter how neurotic I was.
Why is that so heartbreaking to hear?
Why is that hard?
Why is that heartbreaking? Why is there an element of like heartbreak in that idea? Why is there something about, I think about being around that in the flesh, and I feel this strange, like brokenhearted feeling or something. This like, I unworthy, or I don't deserve that. Or you made a mistake here, friend. I don't know why you're around me, or how did I get to be?
Well, that's what I felt when I was there a bunch of the time. Ramdas tells all these stories. Like it seemed like being around Maharaji was just a love fest, and there was great love, but there was also the grace race, and there was guilt, and who gets the name first and who gets the mantra first. And almost all of us brought a real lot of unworthiness to somebody who we saw as completely pure and the embodiment of love. And it was like very difficult not to think of him as so much greater than us, and we were unworthy, and carry a lot of our Judeo-Christian guilt with us to India. I remember one time I was at Maharaj's feet. I got the prime spot where I had one of his feet, and he was talking to people, and I was rubbing his foot, and I was saying my mantra. And after a few minutes, I thought, boy, I'm so lucky I've got his foot. And as soon as I started feeling it, I started pulling his foot away. And I went back to saying my mantra, and then he relaxed his foot, you know. And then after five more minutes, I'm thinking, oh, look at how great I am. I got his foot. He started pulling his foot away again. It happened three times. And as soon as I got involved in it, as soon as I thought, he's great and look what I've got.
Yeah.
That he'd want to pull it away.
That's what I'm talking about right there. That's what I'm talking about. That's the weird dance. It flies in the face of every thing that like you get taught in leadership school, or like, you know, the way that like very sophisticated aggression is lauded as a way to succeed in the world, grabbing for a thing, you know, celebrating the victories and all that. Somehow, is it repulsive? I mean, like, I'm not talking about the physical foot. I'm talking about the sky. It's like longing for the sky brings more clouds or something. This is the part where it gets so writing with your left hand if you're right-handed.
Okay, so I'm getting so excited here. This is great. Because a long time ago, a lot of my knowledge came from Buddhism. And I had what I think is a misunderstanding. I'm not blaming Buddhism, but I thought that desire was bad. Desire caused suffering.
Yes.
And I went to this other teacher, was more like a Sufi kind of guy, and he said there's good desire and there's bad desire. Desire for wholeness, desire for God, desire to be a more loving person is a holy thing. It's a good thing. And desire that it's coming out of attachment and hope and greed is a bad thing.
Right.
It's going to cause suffering. So see which desire is causing suffering in your life, seeing which desire is leading you more deeply into joyfulness. I mean, in Tibetan Buddhism, they say that compassion is a mixture of sadness and joy. You're sad that there's suffering, but there's a joyfulness that your heart is open. There's a joy that transcends happiness and sadness.
Wow.
So that you're able to be joyful even though children are dying of cancer and the planet's environment is getting screwed up by greed and on and on and on.
You get both. You don't. It's like if you're feeling sad, you're saying, that is not a sign that things have run amok in your practice or your life. It's not a sign that you're like still not there. It's actually a very good sign. It doesn't have to be bad. And if you're desiring this sky connection, why are you being chased? You don't have to exercise the same sort of like resistance to that desire that you might to other desires. That's really beautiful. It's you get to like have that romance. You don't have to be approved.
You get to experience the subtle difference, the sometimes subtle difference between attachment and preference.
Ah, right.
Like, when are you acting from a place of openness and preference and here's what life wants from me right now, my body wants, people want, like, and when am I acting from this place of tightness and grasping, right? There's a different feeling that it's hard to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Because it means looking at our narcissism and our greed and all that kind of stuff.
Yep. Yeah, it's a different, I know what you mean, though. It is a, one thing makes me want to win. You know, like one involves aggression. One is like, I want to be right. I want to win. I want to win this one. The other one, it's just like, okay, I don't have to, like, I'm not dying. There's no hill to die on here, right? That's the idea. It's very different. Definitely one involves cortisol more than the other, right? That's what you're saying.
Could you explain to me why you like martial arts so much?
Me?
Yeah.
Why do you think I like martial arts?
Mixed martial arts, you're a fan of that?
Oh, my God. For a moment, I'm like, my friend, you have made a terrible mistake. I couldn't fight my poodle if I wanted to.
No, but you're a big fan of people beating each other up.
Okay, a big fan. I wouldn't. My friend works with the UFC, and so he has many times gotten me front row seats, and I've gotten to watch it. Now, the reason I like it for a lot of different reasons. One reason that I like it is the athleticism. It's insane, like what these people are doing and the pressure they're under and the way they're executing what they're doing is incredible. The other thing that later down the line is you realize generally they're not angry, and after the fights they hug each other. It's the craziest thing you've ever seen when someone who looks like their face just got hit with a hammer is hugging the person who did that to their face, and not in a BS way, but like with love and respect. And that's a pretty wild thing to see. It's very interesting. Also, it's cool to watch people beat each other up. I'm sorry, Ben.
So I'm suggesting there can be the mixed martial art of life of being Duncan, or the martial art of being Duncan, that it's like, it's not like you're not into victory and accomplishment.
Right, I gotcha.
But it's coming from this place of openness and non-grasping.
Got it. Gotcha. You're so smart. That's so cool. I get it. It's like the difference between a street fight and a UFC fight. Like, it's so beautiful. That's so cool. That's so cool. That's so cool. Again, some UFC fights are like street fights. They hate each other, and it's like really weird when that happens. But that's really cool. It's like sort of engage like a professional fighter in your own reality. And also the other thing is, you meet them. When I've been lucky enough to meet them, they are the sweetest people. There's no, like, I don't know, machismo or generally, I mean, you know, they're generally like seem very lucid, awake, and they do have a similar vibe to when you run into someone who's been practicing for a long time, like that clarity, that sort of like sparkly clarity.
It's, well, to do what they're doing and not get paralyzed and deeply injured, is it takes a great deal of mindfulness and clarity and presence, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
They have to be really great athletes to do what they're doing and not get hurt.
I am so thrilled with the things that you've been teaching me. It's the best. It's like the best, and it always happens at exactly the right time. I'm really kind of like, and you know, I not to put something weird on you, but whenever I'm chatting with you, I feel like I'm with Ram Dass. It's like getting to have the conversations I wish I'd gotten to have with Ram Dass. I really like my interactions with him. I wish I'd had the chance, but I feel like
I was lucky enough to live with him before he had the stroke and everything. And, he was a remarkable, remarkable guy. And he had his own stuff. I mean, he was going through it just like everybody. And I think the stroke is what really softened him and opened him and completed him in the end.
You know, one of the joys of going to those retreats and meeting everyone in that community is the realization of like, oh, Ram Dass is just the most well-known Ram Dass. There are countless Ram Dasses at those retreats, you know. Yeah. He's just the one that got the biggest spotlight. And seeing that, you know, it's really like one of the sweetest things. And also seeing like, and just like Ram Dass had his own stuff. It's not to say the other Ram Dasses aren't dealing with their own, whatever maybe, you know, but that energy is so similar. I mean, this is for me how I feel like I have gotten to meet Maharaji. How, and all the, you know, off microphone stuff, you probably could guess the like wild stuff aside. That's how I really connect to the energy. Is it's like there is an identical, what did you call it? The stink of enlightenment. You all stink the same. have the same stink.
I think the stink of enlightenment is a kind of a different thing. That's when you're grasping an enlightenment and it's kind of really defiling your life. But yeah, I mean, we all have Maharaji died. He didn't have any successor really. And everybody, he broke into 1,000 pieces and we've all got a little piece or something.
Dandelion. He did a dandelion effect and it worked. And it's incredible because it reminds me, when I made a real connection with Christianity for the first time, it's because I took acid, went into my dorm room, and started reading the Book of John, and I was drinking wine. I remember I was drinking shitty college wine. I'm reading the Book of John. I'm tripping, and it occurred to me, someone wrote this. Like, whether the validity of this is aside, like, what mind wrote these words in this order? Like, what was the consciousness of the person who wrote this down like? Then it was like, that was the Christ consciousness, an experience of Jesus, like a feeling of the thing connecting with Ram, the like, oh, it's in the thumbprint. This is the thumbprint through a human consciousness. That's what I feel like y'all are like, you have this thumbprint of this being that is just in you. And one of the qualities is you all have the most succinct way of bringing these very wild concepts down to earth in a way people like us can understand. That's, to me, the, if I had to look at the similarity, regardless of lineage, regardless of bhakti or non-dualist or Zen or Christian, it's that. It's that. And that is a really incredible thing.
If I might, let me say, I do this professionally when I'm not talking to you. And there's this thing called the Living Dying Project that I started with Ram Dass a long time ago, that we felt that the place that where was the biggest gap to consciousness in America was the encounter with life-threatening illness. So yes. Steve Levine, Ram Dass, and me started the Conscious Dying Movement. And I run this thing called the Living Dying Project, livingdying.org, which is really not about dying. It's about healing, about how the way we live determines how we die, and the fact we're going to die should hopefully determine the way we're going to be living. So if you go to our website, there's like free, a lot of free information, the most complete site on the internet about conscious dying. There's online workshops, and there's support groups for people with illness and caregivers and grieving people. And we're having a speaker series where there's this woman, Jetsun Ma Tenzin Palmo, who spent 12 years in a cave in the Himalayas, is going to come. I mean, she's not going to come. She's in India, but and she doesn't speak in public anymore, but she's agreed to have a conversation with me on January 21st.
Wow.
So there's all that stuff. Come to our website, and a lot of free, great stuff.
Friends, all the links you need to find Ramdev are going to be at DougAtrussell.com, and I hope you will dive deeper with this amazing human. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
I love being with you, Duncan.
Likewise.
Ram Ram.
Ram Ram. That was Ramdev, everybody. Definitely check out the Living Dying Project. All the links you need to find Ramdev will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Big thank you to HelloFresh and MyBookie. Give them a shot. Use those offer codes. Thank you so much for continuing to listen to the DTFH, and I will see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.